Welcome to Power Station. I am so glad to be here today with two terrific guests, and we are going to be talking about an array of issues, but particularly about criminal expungements and other work that is done by Maryland Legal Aid Bureau. We're going to talk more about what the organization is and does and how it operates. And we have two people who are really deeply involved in the community-focused project, which is providing information and services in libraries and other community venues. It's all very exciting and fascinating, so we're going to get into it. And I'd like to start by asking Amy and Dimitri to both introduce themselves. Amy has been here before, and I'm really happy to welcome you back. So, Amy, can you talk about what you do, what your role is? Because it's a large role, and I know it not only incorporates providing the services in the community, but it also involves advocacy and pro bono and bringing people in to be part of your really growing team.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, and thank you for having us back here today.
It's my pleasure.
We're excited to be here. My name is Amy Petkosek. I am a director of advocacy at Maryland Legal Aid, and we, in my unit, the Community Lawyer Initiative, is one of the units that I oversee. We provide services in the communities across the state of Maryland to low-income individuals who need our assistance.
That is part of sort of the formula of legal aid, is you are a service that receives federal and other funding that enables you to provide for the unmet legal needs of lower-income people in the community.
That's right. So we are free lawyers for poor people who need help. That's the quickest way to put it.
Okay.
And we are funded by a number of sources, federal, state, local grants, private donors, foundations, all of the above.
And Dimitri, tell me what your role in this work is.
Sure. Well, thank you for having me, having us today. My name is Dimitri Digbue, and I'm a paralegal in the Community Lawyer Initiative, the unit that is placing an emphasis on providing civil legal representation to clients in the community and in a space where they are often already frequenting and already trust. So oftentimes it's libraries, schools, any space that we've seen that communities have expressed to us where they would like to see us more often. My emphasis has been South Baltimore, and as a sort of a community advocate in a way that allows for clientele to direct the way that we would show up for them. So in some of our neighborhoods, they are working on developing the tenant councils that will be there for them when developers are asking what can be done on the land that they're living on currently. So it's an array of things, but ranging from expungements to fair housing and affordability advocacy.
Yes, so that's a lot of territory there. You know, I want to take a moment to say that Wilhelm Joseph is an amazing leader. I know you know that. I knew him 150 years ago in New York City when he was in the legal aid and legal services world there. And besides that, he's really fun and charismatic and great to have at all of the legal services and legal aid parties. What I've seen him do in Maryland is really be a bridge builder and develop the Legal Aid Bureau into a really amazing organization that is so embedded in the community where he serves. And Maryland is a big state with very different terrain and composition and communities, but also to be a leader for the message of legal aid, which, as you said, Amy, is legal services for poor people. So he's been very effective, as you have, in bringing together pro bono attorneys from law firms and from engaging community partners at the grassroots level in every sort of level of engagement. So I don't know if you want to share sort of anything about him, but I just feel that although he doesn't run a personality-driven organization, who he is has sort of advanced this lens of bringing a human rights agenda to a legal aid bureau.
He would tell you there's no way you could have known him 150 years ago because he's only 29 years old.
Well, maybe that's true. Maybe I exaggerated a little bit.
But you are absolutely correct in your assessment of what he has brought to legal aid as the executive director for the past 20 years. His vision of knowing the needs of our clients and making sure that others across the state, whether they be the judiciary, the pro bono attorneys, colleagues, and friends who may be giving us money, and partners in community organizations, that everyone understands the plight of our clients, whether it be the rural poor or the urban poor, but what their day-to-day life is like and how the role of a lawyer can change that forever. And that message, whether it be on a fundraising level or on a delivery of services level, is embedded in every staff member that he has hired. And we have about 350 staff right now. And over the past two decades plus, he's seen many more come through and go on, and they carry that legal aid message with them. And his leadership has helped inform this development in the past 4 years of the Community Lawyering Initiative, which we really see in Maryland as a new way to provide legal services.
So let's say more about that. And first, that number is staggering. 350, did you say? That's an amazing number. And how many different offices?
We have 12 offices across the state of Maryland. So we are everywhere from up in the mountains in Allegheny and Garrett County, down on the shore. We're urban around the District of Columbia and Prince George's and Montgomery counties. We're in the state capital in Annapolis. We have some staff in southern Maryland, in the middle of the state, of course, as well. And then we have a large office in Baltimore City.
So to sort of embed that ethos of human rights, which he does, into the organization, that takes a lot of intentionality. How does that happen? How does that sort of set of values come down in through the organization in the way that it does?
We commemorate Human Rights Day at Legal Aid every year in December. We have an all-day, all-staff conference that picks a new topic, whether it be racial equity, which it was last year, or in disability awareness. Every year, it's a different topic where we do a day of trainings on how staff can be aware of issues and then incorporate legal human rights arguments into their everyday work. We have staff that have positions such as senior attorney or senior paralegal just for human rights. We have a task force, a human rights task force that meets on a bi-monthly basis to talk about ways we can incorporate this in our work. And so it's really, it's not just one project or one thing.
Yes.
It's embedded into the everyday values of Maryland Legal Aid.
That's really important. The other sort of infrastructure observation I have is that you have a very robust staff of non-lawyers, of the paralegals and other people within the organization. That seems really important because you're valuing all of the different services that people can provide and also the relationships that they can help to build. Is that an intentional step as well? It would seem to be.
Without a doubt. The paralegals and administrative staff are the front line of the organization. Mm. Whether we are at a library or someone calls on the phone, the first staff member the client encounters is usually not an attorney. And so that first interaction is what sets the ground for if they feel welcomed, if they feel like this is a place they can trust. And often in order to meet qualification guidelines, these paralegals are asking intensely personal information. Mm. How many children do you have? How much money do you make? And our staff does it in such a way to make the client feel comfortable, at ease, not set out on a pedestal, but really, how can we help you? How can we get you to the lawyer as soon as we can? And we also have a lot of paralegals that step a level further and do a lot of advocacy at administrative hearings that help with our expungement petitions under the guidance of an attorney, that really step into the advocacy realm that may testify in Annapolis. We've been invited by legislators to do some expungement advocacy, and we've been bringing our paralegal staff down with us. They are tremendous advocates for our clients. And so that's one of the reasons I brought Dimitri with me today.
Yes.
Is that the paralegals and community lawyering are very important to the success of the unit.
I'm really interested to hear from you, Dimitri, your experience. Let's first set the stage for your work in the libraries,
yeah,
because that's exciting. And I know that the field is growing into other venues. But how did this start? And what was your thought about being in the libraries? I mean, I think we all bring a lot of sort of feelings to what libraries can be and the role that they can play for children, for families, for getting information, for being sort of a community builder. But we don't necessarily think about, let's work on expunging criminal charges and records off of people who might be able to benefit from that. How did that start? And what does it look like now?
So it started in 2015 after the unrest, after the death of Freddie Gray in police custody in Baltimore City. Our chief operating officer, Ms. Toller, saw the news. In West Baltimore, the CVS was burning down, and across the street was the West Baltimore branch of the Pennsylvania Avenue Enoch Pratt,
yes,
Library. That librarian, Melanie Townsend Diggs, kept that library open as a safe haven. And our COO thought, why not put lawyers there if it's such a safe place? We had a wonderful contact, Mr. Ben Rosenberg, who is a local attorney, a great fundraiser for Legal Aid, and also a member of the board of the Enoch Pratt Library. He was able to connect us within a month. And within 2 months, we were in that library, and we continue. That's our flagship branch of the program, although we are in over 45 libraries across the city and state now.
45, wow.
We still go to that library every week, and we see about 40 to 45 people every single Tuesday, different people every week, and now it's been since 2015. And so we've expanded our services, but the library is a place that people trust. You know, Reader's Digest just named Enoch Pratt Free Library in Baltimore one of the 10 nicest places in America.
Oh, that's
and,
wonderful.
Through a program with Good Morning America, and they did a special, and libraries are nice places.
They are.
And people don't always think of lawyers or their legal troubles as nice things.
No.
And so when you pair those together, it's like a perfect marriage of a place that a client can feel welcome,
yes,
that they already go to for their children to play,
yes,
to seek information, sometimes just to stay warm,
or yes,
to use a computer for free, and where we can really on site give them a will, give them an expungement,
yes,
tell them how to get a divorce,
yes,
tell them how to not be evicted from their house. So it's a really essential service, and we're awful proud of it and excited about expanding it.
As you should be. And in the context of the death of Freddie Gray in police custody, it has a lot of meaning because, as you said, Amy, this was where there was so much damage and destruction and sort of a very grim environment to have that library open and to be such a vehicle for support and assistance is important. So what does it look like now when you go into a session at Enoch Library, Dimitri? What do you see? Who's there? How have you gotten people there?
Having been a part of this unit since September 10th, this has literally been every single Tuesday of my life.
Wow.
Has been from 1 to 3 p.m. We've set up sort of like a doctor's office clinics where the first two stations are committed to just the intake and the sign up. So you get a folder, you walk in, and you explain what the legal area you're interested in. And you have an array of choices between family law and housing and bankruptcy, as well as administrative law. So on top of the expungements, you're able to figure out whether this is a good opportunity for you to also seek out whether or not this lease is actually in your favor or not.
Well,
or
that's a good point.
I can appeal the unemployment benefit that I just got denied.
Yes, because we're humans. We have intersecting issues going on in our lives. And if you're struggling in one area, you're probably struggling in another. So that's a lot of to do to navigate those different pieces of legal issues within a one person situation.
We've also placed additional partners in that library with us during that time slot who have the same need to reach our clients, and clients could benefit from that. For example, for a time, there was a monitor on the Baltimore Police Consent Decree with the federal government. So a monitor of that decree took place during Lawyer in the Library and set up a little station. We've also had a Skadden Fellow who partnered with Legal Aid because he has a project on bail bonds and the consumer abuses that happen to family members when they try and get involved with bail bonds. And
yes,
very unscrupulous behavior.
Yes.
And he now, on his own, has been able to take legal action with his own organization because of clients that he met and encountered at the library. So the library really provides a vehicle for other entities to come and interact with the community and find out what's really going on.
Well, I think it also says, right, that people who are low income and tend to be marginalized in a variety of ways are going to be the subject of sort of predatory schemes and just not having legal supports and assistance where they need it. So you may be coming in at a different stage of their situations.
Yes, and our clients lack power all across the board. And the library is a place where they are empowered. It is their library, their community, and we are coming there, not as helpers, but as listeners, to find out what's going on and to then react and further empower community members.
Dimitri, what is sort of the profile of the people who show up? Is it across the board sort of women? Is it men? Who's there? And when you do the outreach to them, is there a hurdle for you to get over in getting them to come there and to see Legal Aid and the library as a partnership that's supporting them?
Yeah, I mean, we are serving a variety of folks at the Penn North Library. I think it is very reflective of the city as a whole, where we know it's 62% African-American.
62%,
and,
yes.
And we do find a tendency for that space is to reflect that. And
yes,
it's a lot of younger folks, but we do have folks who are above 30 and are figuring out what the next move is for their employment status. And so it's difficult to give one specific standard client because it varies so widely.
Mm-hmm.
But we are at a spot that is a transportation hub in the city.
Mm.
It's widely accessible for the entire West Baltimore region. And it gives us kind of a pulse on what it is going to be like as a legal service provider in Baltimore City. The thing is, it has also been, as Amy said, 40 to 45 people. It's been a steady flow like that for the past 3 years. More specifically, from January to December of this past year, we've seen 737 clients and have filed 1,700 petitions. And that was only in five months.
Wow, that's a tremendous number. I would imagine that Baltimore City, I think, is thought of as sort of a microcosm of where there is tremendous racial and economic segregation in communities, and that's reflected in your experience at the library. Is that accurate?
Yeah, we've seen, you know, in 2016, data has shown that Baltimore has led the nation per capita in fentanyl overdoses, homicides, police spending. A lot of these intersections have led to the needs that we see on a consistent basis every single Tuesday. And as you said, they do intersect.
Yes.
And what starts as a civil matter often leads to a criminal matter.
Mm-hmm.
And while our Constitution gives a legal right for anyone who's convicted in a criminal court, they have no right to that in civil cases.
Yes. Say that again, because that's really important for people still to grapple with and understand that in a criminal proceeding, there is the right to counsel that does not exist, correct?
Absolutely.
In the civil proceedings.
There is no civil Gideon. In the case Gideon
yes.
v. Wainwright, there was a, thankfully, a right to counsel in a criminal case. But unfortunately, there is no right to counsel if
yes.
someone is taking your home away, if someone is domestically abusing you. There just is no right to counsel. And it's a horrific case, especially in cases that affect people's human rights.
Let's talk a little bit about the expungements. And what does that mean? To whom does it apply? As I said to you before we started, it still sort of boggles my mind that this is not just about convictions, but it is about charges. Is that correct?
That is correct. You can be picked up, arrested, and the charges are dropped. They're what's called null prost, not prosecuted.
Okay.
That can be happen on your record 55 times. And so when an employer looks up your record, it looks like it's 55 items long and you will never get a job, even though you've never been convicted of anything. And so we are expunging those charges, yes. Or if something is placed on what's called the STET docket, basically on a shelf for 3 years, and then there's a decision not to prosecute, those also remain on your record. Or if there's a not guilty or an acquittal, those actually stay on your record.
Even an acquittal.
And so there needs to be a paperwork process done that we assist with at the library. Additionally, Maryland, over the past 3 or 4 years, has really changed its laws around expungement, and there are some pending bills in the legislature this session that may possibly, if they pass, expand it even further, and that's to include convictions for misdemeanors. So after a period of 10 years or 15 years in some other cases, crimes can be taken off your record even if you were found guilty. So if you had a theft charge when you were 20 mm-hmm. years old and now you're 45 and you've never had a meaningful place of employment because of that charge, and that was the only charge in your whole life, we can now expunge that. And the number of times we can do that and look on someone's face when you tell them they're finally going to be able to get better housing, volunteer at their child's school, or get a wage that they can support their family on is unbelievable.
It is unbelievable how impactful that is. When you're sitting down with somebody, Dimitri, and you start to have this conversation with them and explain, do they know what the possibilities are? Or have they just heard that maybe there is some way to remove this charge or conviction from their record that's so much inhibiting their progress? What do they come thinking and what do they hear from you?
Sure, definitely across the board, but you'll find that folks are extremely invested in the removal of these charges from their record. Whether it's having remembrance of the trauma of the experience
yes.
or it's coming up as a conflict in applying for housing, public assistance, or work, they are coming in with a specific purpose and intent in mind and are able to typically articulate what is wrong and what needs to come off.
And how much of the reality of having these charges and convictions on people's records, do you put that in the bureaucratic morass column, and how much is on some sort of intentional weighing down of people so they can't progress in life? I'm asking because you're now going into, or there is the potential for public policy to change in the state that would impact the way that is done. And what is it like to start to articulate what the problem is, why it's there, and what could be done to change that whole paradigm?
In regards to public policy, we are often invited to educate legislators on policy changes. We have some restrictions where we do not actively lobby, but we have been invited to educate recently. And when we do that education, we let them know that what we see in our clients now is a life sentence of unemployment. Mm. However, the reason for why that has been, that is what the reality of the laws show in the day-to-day, whether you are in a rural area up in the mountains or whether you're in the inner city of Baltimore or Prince George's County outside D.C. People cannot work for their entire lives. And so, little by little, those laws are changing and we're opening up the workforce. And that's pretty exciting.
That's amazing. What do you hear from people? What are they saying to you when that happens? Because this is a process, right, that might start at the library, but it's going to take some time to get there. What does that look like? And then what do people tell you about their experience afterwards?
Well, it does, you know, depend on the court with which you're filing these petitions for expungement. But it can range anywhere from 4 months to 8 from the time that we actually have met the person at the library or at the school. And your question about bureaucratic mirage or like nefarious intent, I would say oftentimes the punishment is the process. And it is, you know, it bleeds into both where you have, even in our own city, we do have petitions that take up to a year to end up leading to expungement. And, you know, if we do get word back, and you don't want to say that that's intent, but regardless, it has the same impact.
Yes, that's right. It has the same impact. So are you going to be able to bring, in addition to the attorneys and the paralegals in your network at Maryland Legal Aid Bureau, are people that you are serving going to then become advocates themselves during this policy process at the state capitol? Because that's also a really important role to be able to play in their own advocacy for themselves.
For the past 3 years, every time we are invited to testify in a bill, we have been able to invite clients to come down with us. We've brought clients to Annapolis, and if they can't come, then we have sometimes recorded their stories or spoken to them before our testimony so that their stories truly, if they cannot be there in person, which they sometimes are, but if they can't be, to inform our testimony. We've also brought our clients and their stories after they're successful really into our entire picture of fundraising and encouraging pro bono attorney volunteer support for the organization. So, for example, we had an event with 40 young attorneys across the city, and we brought one of our clients with us so that he could stand up and tell his story, which is very empowering to him and also really results in a lot greater levels of support for legal aid generally.
Do you think that the environment for expungement of criminal records is changing? Is it that people are learning about the problem more? Is it that they're more sympathetic? I'm just wondering if there's some sort of change in the way that people look at who are these people, why are they suffering from this, and that interest in others to help or support policy change or to fundraise around this issue. What's happening there?
Across the country, there's most certainly an awareness level that was not there before and that is growing about the impact that happens well after the conviction and about the impact of a record on employment, on housing, on poverty. It has a tremendous impact. And I know there are many other states. There's a National Clean Slate Clearinghouse that is working on this, working on different advocacy across the country and state by state. Some states have done more than others, but there, I would say there are movements in almost every state by advocates to try and really look at the policy. And then there's individuals like myself and Dimitri on the ground that are not really worried about the policy, but are day to day trying to help clients one by one.
What are some of the stories that you hear that are from those people who walk into the library and they say, this is what happened to me?
I had a client who is a grandmother, wants to volunteer at her grandchild's elementary school. She has a prostitution conviction from 35 years ago, and the elementary school wouldn't let her come and volunteer.
Wow.
One individual who very much wanted to be a social worker, a colleague of mine was his attorney, and could not become a social worker. They were ready to hire him. He went through schooling, but he had one former drug conviction. He could not get that off. He was able to expunge it, and he has now been hired as a social worker. We have an individual who couldn't work as a security guard because of a very old 20-year-old theft conviction, and he has five children and a wife that he's trying to support. He's now been reported back, hired as the security guard, got that off his record. So, I mean, I could literally go on for days.
And I guess you really can't escape the irony. I'm just thinking of the various convictions that we've heard about recently within our presidential administration. It's kind of remarkable to think that this just has so much to do with class and color and where you stand in society about what the acceptance level is for either something that one has done in the past or not done in the past and how it's going to affect their future. Amy, you made the really important point that the ability of somebody to earn an income and be a taxpayer and being a part of solutions in the community and in society is completely jeopardized by these criminal convictions that are not expunged. And I would think that would be an important point in your public policy advocacy because everybody wants that.
Certainly, we make it a point when we are educating legislators, when we're invited to do so, that we educate them on what we see. And what we see in West Baltimore is that people have 55 charges, not convictions, for loitering or standing on a corner. And we don't see that same thing in other neighborhoods and other areas of the city. And so we are not really in the policy business, but we are most certainly in the empowering our clients and telling their stories and making their voices be a little louder. And that's what we see every day.
So this really gets to a law enforcement issue as well.
100%. We see not only in Baltimore, but specifically in Baltimore, how a legacy of over-policing and abuses that have led to illegal arrests that have led to this over-inflation of folks who are left with few options. Mm. And we are claiming to want to reduce recidivism and to make sure that folks have an opportunity while giving them no real path. So it is a combination of not repeating the mistakes from the past and figuring out why our actions aren't leading to the outcomes we're claiming.
You're taking on a lot. There's so much that's packed into, right, how that person gets there. And that has to do with law enforcement and the availability of legal services and the community that they came from and the degree of the racial wealth divide and the economic and racial segregation. In many cities, and Baltimore really is up there as a real microcosm of that picture. So, Amy, what is it like to bring other lawyers and law firms and people sort of into this initiative with you and to grow those relationships with the libraries also?
The whole point of this initiative is to go into communities, to develop trust, to listen to clients there, by bringing in so many different perspectives and voices that can be part of that movement. And when I say that, it's talking to the neighborhood associations, to the tenant councils, to the other groups, to the doctors. There are community doctors that work in these communities that we're now starting to partner with. And bringing in more help. I mean, I only have so many lawyers I can fund in my unit, but when we bring in volunteer attorneys, when you go to a law firm and talk about this, we now have law firms adopting schools in these communities, coming to do expungement and brief advice clinics with us. My workforce can multiply if I bring in those volunteer law students, volunteer lawyers, and introduce them to the community organizations. It's a very holistic way of looking at a community. It is not a clinic where you go in on one Saturday and you might come back 6 months later or you might not.
Yes.
It is a different kind of clinic where the clinic is informed by what's going on in the community, where you're also listening to the leaders who have lived there for decades about what the housing looks like now, what it looked like 20 years ago, and what they want it to look like 20 years in the future. And at the same time, while you're listening to them, providing direct services for an eviction that might happen tomorrow or for an expungement that they want off their record immediately.
Yes.
It's doing all that at once. And I think that's how we as a legal aid truly take it to a human rights level and take us into the future.
That's such a good point. I mean, that really is that vision that's on your website and that's very embedded in the work that you do about advancing human rights, because this really is what it comes down to. You mentioned working in the schools. That's very exciting. I mean, obviously, that's where parents are with children and have incredible investment in their community and incredible set of needs. So what has that been like?
Is our new frontier. It is our mission for 2019 and beyond to really incorporate schools the way we have with libraries on a three-prong approach. First, by educating teachers about legal issues that they may see so they know when to refer a client to us if they have a family in need, because teachers are really the front line. It's also empowering students, middle and high school students, on advocacy projects in their own communities and teaching them to be self-advocates and to know their rights from a very young age. And then the third level is lawyer in the school, like a lawyer in the library. Those parents have to be in that school for their kids, often twice a day, many times a week. And the school is a place they trust, as they should.
Yes.
And so we want to be there in that school with the parent-teacher organizations, helping on one-on-one advice with expungements, with domestic violence advice, with eviction advice and bankruptcy, and really being a part of that school community. We have a school South Baltimore, one in West Baltimore. We're just starting to open up this avenue. And like I said before, law firms are really excited about helping us and making our staff stretch a little further and coming in with our support and really helping that entire school community, because anybody can volunteer in a school with us. The school needs a lot that's not just legal.
Yes.
And so if they want to help some students with a garden or with a mural, we can bring in non-legal volunteers from those firms, from our communities, and provide legal advice at the same time with our attorneys.
Yes.
And so it's the holistic way of helping the school that we are really excited about moving forward in Baltimore and then across the state.
It's very exciting. What are you seeing, Dimitri, as this sort of program builds out, even in the fairly short time that you've been involved with this? What does this kind of growth and this trajectory look like to you? How do you see it impacting the community?
I think there are unique strategies depending on where you are. So what might be of interest to folks in West Baltimore might not be what they're doing in South Baltimore. So the high schools we found are always the place where community ingenuity is fostered and
yes.
begins to start to branch out from there. We've seen already that there are high school students in South Baltimore working to organize around bringing down the incinerator that is for a while contributing to the higher than average asthma rates, and have been standing up finally for the way that their neighborhood has been treating as a landfill. So for them, it might be simply attending community association meetings, offering advice on what is going on with their landlords, and figuring out a way to just be someone in their space and in their corner.
Yes. And have you sort of felt any pushback institutionally from the city or individuals who are sort of not on board with what you're doing? Or are you really finding that this is building a higher, better level of understanding and sort of cohesion around the issues that you deal with?
Yeah, not to sound Pollyanna-like, but no, there's not pushback. So the city has been incredibly supportive. The mayor's office runs a workforce development bus. It's equipped with resume building stations, and they drive it around to the most neighborhoods most in need that don't have access to services. And they're now allowing legal aid to put our lawyers on the bus to do expungements and go around the city. That's just one example of the many ways the city and Maryland Legal Aid are partnering together, mostly around workforce development and putting community lawyers. We didn't talk about that a lot today, but we have a whole part of our unit that goes into city-funded workforce development centers that are training people who have records to go into, whether they've been expunged or they still have records, to construction jobs, to jobs on the Port of Baltimore, to CNA and GNA jobs once they get their records expunged. And Legal Aid is partnering to provide civil legal help through a whole cadre of attorneys that are just doing workforce development services.
So, I mean, that's incredibly important, because if they are gaining the skills, but they don't have the actual ability to get into that workforce, they're just as stuck as they were before. So you're moving them together past that through this collaboration.
Right. And it's the perfect venue, because the clients are already in a brain space where they want to learn and move their life forward. So they're learning a skill, right? So they're in classes for construction, and they take a lunch break, and then they go to a class on knowing your legal rights.
Yes.
And looking at your whole life and seeing what's stressing you out, and does that have a legal root? And this lawyer's right here in the next room, so stop by and they'll help you on your way out today.
Right.
And they really get it taken care of, and it really pushes the community forward and makes that workforce development money worth it, because the client can actually get the job.
Well, also, you know, this is sort of the word of the day, right? Intersectionality. Our issues are all, they intersect. And this is how any sort of the, I think, more savvy nonprofit organizations that deal with a specific issue are more engaged right now in working with others where their paths align. And it seems that's what you're doing. So you're doing that in all these interesting venues. Are you doing that also in partnership with nonprofits beyond your own? Where do they fit into this mix?
I think that other nonprofits have been ahead of us in collaborating with each other. For example, the food bank has been partnering with the homeless shelter, but the legal services, I think, are a step behind. And so we are partnering with many, many nonprofits, whether they be homeless shelters, food banks, drug treatment centers, whatever they may be, across the city of Baltimore and across the state of Maryland, and really looking at our services and how we can all work together, because that really is the new frontier. It is that intersectionality. Yes. It is looking at the big picture. And clients shouldn't have to go to six places when they already can't make ends meet. They should be able to go to one place and get all of those things. And we, as the nonprofit thought leaders, need to be able to figure that out for them and put it all in one place.
And that's apparently what you've done, which is really great. So we talk on Power Station about building community influence and power. Some organizations are more comfortable than others in articulating what they do in that way, or maybe it doesn't fit, or there's a better way to do it. Does that fit for you both? Do you see the work that you're doing as building community influence and power?
I absolutely do. I want Dimitri to talk about some of the work that he's done as well, but I would say that we, especially in community lawyering, listen to the community so much. We've taken on a civil legal issue that legal aid never did before, and very few legal aids in the country do, and that's civil forfeiture. And briefly, that's when the police make an arrest, and that person may not be ever prosecuted, so the charge is dropped, but the police keep that property, whether it be money or the car, and the client never sees that again, even though they were not found guilty. And so there's a civil action to get that money back, and we are now taking and successfully completing those cases, and that only came out of listening to the community. Those clients told us, the police are taking our stuff. And we went and we investigated it, and we spent a lot of time developing it, talking to people across the country. And now we have a civil forfeiture group in our community lawyering unit. And that really is client empowerment at its finest. Then the community telling us what they need, and then us implementing those services. And then Dimitri has done some really neat work when he was working at the libraries over in South Baltimore to help the surrounding community.
Well, yeah, we're at an interesting time in South Baltimore's, I guess, history, where you have a large developer that is, you know, received a $600 million plus incentive by the city to build out their headquarters. And our focus has been, how does that impact the neighbors and the residents that are in the adjacent communities?
Yes.
So having already had a presence in Cherry Hill, we've figured that that is our opportunity to lead from behind and give them services and the technical skills that we provide to provide whatever leadership that they see, deem fit. And particularly in Cherry Hill, it's been, how do we make sure the housing that comes in is affordable for those of us who currently do not see market rate affordability coming down the pipeline for us?
Like, this is sort of the rub, right? That in this world of Baltimore in particular, where there is so much difficulty and inequity, there is also investment, but the issue becomes for whom? And you were able to really galvanize some of the voices from the community around those issues.
Yeah, it starts with listening, going to the meetings that are already there and are being proximate to folks who are living this on the daily.
Yes.
We know that market forces are on the way, and the goal is preservation and preserving what we currently have. And I think there are unique approaches to this. Some neighbors are talking about building out community land trusts in a way that can kind of survive the rising prices and the rising cost of living in the neighborhood.
Yes.
And also groups that are bringing in larger, more, I guess, skilled approaches to this sort of advocacy. And we know United Workers and people are doing larger affordable housing work and focusing in on how does that imply a specific neighborhood like Cherry Hill.
Yes.
What money is left for us when we do see that there is $600 million being spent?
And like,
what does that mean for us?
Yes, exactly.
And I will say that when I first went to the Cherry Hill community, to the library, and said, oh, a library, we'll put a lawyer in the library here. They were like, oh, no one uses that library. That's not one of our most frequented branches. The community doesn't really go in there. And when we first set up a lawyer there, we really weren't getting many clients. I mean, it was proving true. And we started sending our staff, like Dimitri, to these community meetings, to looking at what's going on in South Baltimore as a whole, much of which he's spoken to. And suddenly now the library is a thriving place during Lawyer in the Library. And we're having a Know Your Rights class there, and people are attending. And it's very interesting how that all intersects.
They're feeling welcome there now, and there's a reason. And that opens the door to the other uses of the library for them, which is exciting. So I want to just switch it up a little bit and ask both of you about your paths into doing this work. Because both of you are very committed, and I'm interested in hearing how sort of your initial experience brought you to this place and what you see the trajectory of this program and the Legal Aid Bureau being. Amy, can we start with you?
Sure. When I went to college, I did a lot of service work, both in the Appalachian region of the United States and in Mexico, Tijuana, Mexico, and some southern parts, and just really firsthand experienced meeting and interacting with individuals living in poverty and watched how their communities were thriving with love, with the investment that they had in the communities that they were given. And so really wanted to be a part of a career that could impact and help empower those individuals. I also will say that I grew up as a little girl, like, I mean, 6, 7 years old, saying I'm going to be a librarian one day. That's what I would write on my papers. When I first went to Lawyer in the Library on its very first day, I sort of fell in love with the project and had a vision for it ever since. And it has really evolved in my mind and been informed by not only the community members and the clients and by our executive director and his staff, but by the people that we've hired. Dimitri and his colleagues, our team is absolutely incredible. They each bring, there's about 20 of them now, and they each bring such a unique perspective and life experience that helps inform the work. I constantly am going to them and saying, what new ideas do you have? And in terms of going forward, I see Maryland Legal Aid and civil legal services in general taking this community intersectionality approach to the next level. Mm-hmm. That is the way we will thrive.
Yes.
And more importantly, that our clients will thrive is that if we look at it that way going forward.
Yes.
This has been a natural progression for my own personal evolution and understanding what are the root causes of these challenges that we face nationally. Initially, I graduated with a focus and emphasis on economics and political science. I went to D.C. to work for an education organization, and I spent most of the year in a fifth grade English classroom. And that led me to understanding the level to which housing was a barrier to a child's education.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a few students that had to leave the district and end up going to what D.C. residents often call Ward 9 or PG County when it's no longer affordable.
Mm-hmm.
And finding out and having friends in Baltimore, but finding out that Baltimore led the nation a few years ago in evictions and foreclosures per capita.
Yes.
And knowing the way that a deindustrialized city can now have a percentage of vacant homes that are just weighing down the rest of the folks who still occupy the neighborhoods, I wanted to learn more, and I joined a homeless organization or homeless housing organization and spent a lot of that time doing outreach and figuring out what is the way that we can deal with homelessness in our specific Southwest neighborhood. And that naturally led me to realizing that most folks are dealing with criminal records, and most folks have been, you know, not even looked at by landlords and are dealing with a lot of more institutional barriers.
Yes.
And the group I kept sending my clients to was Maryland Legal Aid. And so, you know, always having law school as a thought in the back of my mind and seeing the way laws are kind of an undercurrent to the exploitation that we see. And here we are today. And I think Baltimore can be a model for the way that we can start bringing proximity and community advocacy to legal services work as well.
Yes.
And, you know, our unit is deemed the community lawyering unit because we have decided that the community is going to lead all of our work and it's going to be the heart of what we do.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a different model than the traditional legal model. And I think that, like all of the things we've discussed, the time is now for changing systems that aren't working for people. So your sort of overarching point of view, which is human rights and being in the community and offering what you have and starting with listening, is so critical. We've talked about the work that you're doing, certainly pieces of it, and about the way that you're getting out there, about the potential for changes in public policy. And also, I'm thinking that part of your influence is on institutions that need change, like the law enforcement, and that maybe you're pushing them in a direction or building some awareness, maybe some trust. Is there something in there that we didn't get to?
I think you've really covered a lot of what we're doing and what we're excited to do in the future. We have been having law enforcement as a partner in many of our endeavors. In West Baltimore, we partnered with Macy's and Clothes for Souls to give free winter coats out, 3,000 coats, brand new coats. And we did coats in legal clinics. And the West Baltimore Police Force came and helped us with that. They put coats on kids. And so we've really relied on them and their partnership. We are actually in 2 weeks attending their Western Baltimore Police District Fair that they have for the community. We'll be doing expungements alongside the police at the fair.
That's
so we thank our law enforcement partners and we're helping them to partner and to assist the community.
I guess I would just say that we need to recognize the humanity and folks that often are left out and are deemed, you know, disposable by the larger consciousness of decision making in this country. And we don't realize the way that it is an indictment on ourselves, and that the harm we cause to others are the harm that we will ultimately feel ourselves. You know, this feels very intuitive for some of us, but for others, this is a time to start reflecting on what this country can look like going forward and who we want to include in that country as well.
That's really true. I want to thank you both so much, Amy Petskosek and Dimitri Dubieu.
Yes, yeah.
It's a beautiful name. I want to thank both of you so much for being here and for coming from Baltimore to have this conversation. It's really exciting. Just a few thoughts. You know, one of the things we've been talking about here at Power Station, again, about libraries, is another way that they're going to become so important in the next year is with the Census 2020 rollout. It's going to be mostly a digital experience. And so that's going to change up the experience for many people, and libraries are going to be very important. We talked a little bit before we started about Ron Hantz and the Network for Developing Conscious Communities and the sort of intentionality behind the community development work, not just the nuts and bolts financing, but what are we developing and for whom and who's involved? And he starts with listening. So that sounds like it could be a good collaboration too. And you all are so collaborative and so invested in partnership. It's really an honor to have had you on. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So thanks everyone for listening. I hope that you will respond by also looking at the information about Maryland Legal Aid Bureau. Where can they find that information?
It's www.mdlab.org, or just Google Maryland Legal Aid.
Fantastic. So there's opportunities for volunteering, for knowing what's going on in the community, for getting involved, for looking at the issues that we discussed on the national level as well, because that's so important and there is a movement nationally on all of these issues. And before we meet again, please follow me at Power Station Pod and use the power of your station to make a difference. I am Ann Pasmanek. Thank you so much for listening to Power Station.